Usually when we think about a global crisis, there's this expectation that it hits everyone like a massive earth
Oh,
crisis.
absolutely. It's that huge sudden impact.
Right. You see the buildings fall, the supply ships are stuck in ports, the stock markets crash, the destruction is highly visible. I mean, it's on the front page of every single newspaper.
Yeah. And it's a very human tendency, I think, to categorize a disaster based purely on what we can see right on the surface. We look at the empty supermarket shelves and we just assume, well, the problem is simply that the truck didn't arrive today.
But then you peel back the layers of our global food supply, and suddenly that earthquake metaphor just feels completely inadequate. We're actually dealing with a system built on these invisible, almost microscopic fault lines. These are hyperlocal networks that are incredibly fragile, and when they crack, the ripple effects are devastating, but they're often completely unseen by the wider world.
Which is exactly why macro-level economic data only tells half the story. I mean, to actually understand how a global shockwave breaks the food system, you have to zoom all the way in.
Right.
You have to look at the individual moving parts, the biology, the daily logistics, the literal water chemistry.
Exactly. And that is why we are here. Welcome to our deep dive. Today, we are exploring a massive, yet often completely overlooked sector of our global food network.
It's a fascinating topic.
It really is. We're looking at a 2024 academic study from the International Journal of Social Sciences and Education Research by Asedu, Aprakhu, Henna, and Amponsa. And it tracks exactly what happened to local fish farmers in Ghana when the world suddenly locked down.
Specifically in the Sunyani municipality.
Yes, exactly. The aquaculture industry in Sunyani. So, your mission for this deep dive, for you listening right now, is this. We are going to unpack how global supply chain disruptions impact local food security using these Ghanaian pond fish farmers as the ultimate real-world case study for both systemic vulnerability and human resilience.
It's the perfect microcosm for this issue.
Okay, let's unpack this. To really grasp the stakes here, I feel like we first have to understand the sheer scale of what we're actually talking about.
The scale is staggering. I mean, when we talk about aquaculture in Ghana, we are talking about the second largest farmed fish producer in all of sub-Saharan Africa.
Wait, second largest?
Yeah, sitting just behind Egypt. And the growth trajectory before the pandemic hit was just explosive. Production rocketed from roughly 52,000 metric tons in 2019 to 162,000 metric tons by 2023.
Wow, that is a colossal leap in just 4 years.
It's massive.
But looking at the study, that growth is kind of split down the middle between two very different types of farming, right? And that distinction seems crucial for you to understand if you want to see where the system actually breaks.
Yes, exactly. The authors draw a really sharp line between large-scale cage farming and traditional earthen pond aquaculture.
Okay, so cage farming first.
Right, cage farming is what drives a lot of those massive production numbers. Think of these massive submerged enclosures and large bodies of water like Lake Volta. Those are the big commercial operations.
Got it.
They get the logistical support, the foreign investment, all the government research attention, and the specialized supply chains.
I kind of picture that like a giant corporate bread factory. It produces a massive volume. It's highly mechanized, and it has the capital to weather a storm.
That's a great way to put it.
But today we are focusing on the other side of the coin, which is the earthen pond aquaculture. This is where 80% of the yield is Nile tilapia, and the other 20% is African catfish.
Right.
So if cage farming is the corporate factory, these earthen ponds are like a sprawling network of independent, family-run local bakeries. They might be smaller individually, but they are completely embedded in their neighborhoods.
And their impact on the local economy goes far beyond just providing protein. Economists refer to this as having strong backward and forward linkages.
Backward and forward linkages, what does that actually look like on the ground?
Well, a single earthen pond acts as an economic engine for an entire micro-community. So the person raising the tilapia buys from a local feed seller. That seller employs a local transporter.
Okay, I'm tracking.
Then the farmer hires seasonal labor to actually harvest the pond. The harvested fish are then sold to local market women who provide ice and transport, eventually feeding local families. It's this complex web of poverty alleviation.
Wow.
Yeah. If that single pond fails, all those surrounding micro-industries lose their income.
Which brings us to a massive contradiction in the source material that I wanted to ask about. These pond farmers are clearly the bedrock of local food security. Yet the study paints a picture of a system that was practically starving for basic resources long before anyone had ever even heard of a lockdown. Why are they constantly battling a lack of basic technical expertise and relying on extension workers who, the study notes, don't even have vehicles to reach them?
What's fascinating here is the demographic reality of who is actually running these farms, contrasted with the support they receive. If you picture a rural subsistence farmer in your head, the data from this survey of 50 farmers in the Bono region completely shatters that stereotype.
How so?
4 out of 5 of the farmers surveyed had either a tertiary education or a senior high school certificate. Specifically, 62% had tertiary education.
Wait, really? So the vast majority are highly educated?
Highly educated. They are running complex biological systems, managing water chemistry, calculating feed conversion ratios. I mean, this isn't just throwing some breadcrumbs into a puddle.
Right, it's a science.
Far from it, yeah. Earthen ponds are static environments. Unlike a river cage, where flowing water naturally flushes away ammonia and waste, a static pond requires constant monitoring.
Because the water isn't moving.
Exactly. You have to balance the pH, manage dissolved oxygen levels, prevent disease outbreaks. It requires serious technical precision.
And to get that precision, they are supposed to rely on government extension workers, right, from the Ministry of Food and Agriculture.
That's the idea, yeah.
But the study points out that these workers often lack specialized aquaculture training. And more alarmingly, like I mentioned, they don't even have basic logistical support. No vehicles to actually reach the farmers in these remote areas.
So you have this highly educated, highly motivated group of farmers left entirely to fend for themselves. Mm. They're piecing together their operations using whatever, you know, substandard fish feed local vendors have in stock.
Right.
They're battling poor road infrastructure and operating with almost zero access to credit.
To borrow the bakery analogy again, it's like trying to run a bakery where the ovens are constantly breaking, the flour delivery is always late, and the bank refuses to give you a loan to fix the roof.
Exactly.
They were already walking a very frayed tightrope. Which brings us to March 2020. The tightrope snaps, we get the COVID-19 lockdowns, and the study's core findings show that 76% of these farmers affirm that the pandemic severely impacted their day-to-day operations.
And when you look closely at that 76%, a very specific operational failure jumps out. More than 6 in 10 of those impacted farmers, 63% to be exact, pointed to poor hatchery management as the fatal blow to their farms during the lockdown.
Okay, I was looking at the logistics of this, and the timeline just felt contradictory at first. I kept thinking, food production was considered an essential service globally.
Right, it was.
So if the fish are just swimming in the ponds and the farmers are isolated on their own land, why does the physical act of farming suddenly grind to a halt just because people were locked down?
Well, because modern aquaculture isn't just letting fish swim. It's effectively a biological assembly line. And if you break a single link in the conveyor belt, the entire factory floor shuts down.
Okay.
Hatcheries are the starting point of that conveyor belt. It's where the fingerlings, the baby fish, are bred. But fish in captivity, especially in high-density commercial setups, they do not just spawn on command.
Right. They need highly specific environmental cues that are incredibly difficult to replicate artificially.
Precisely.
Yep.
So to get them to reproduce reliably, farmers rely on specialized pharmaceuticals. The study highlights the use of pituitary hormones.
Pituitary hormones.
Yeah. These hormones are injected into the brood stock, the parent fish, to induce spawning. This ensures a predictable, massive yield of fry. But these hormones aren't manufactured in the local village. They are part of a highly specialized international supply chain.
Ah. So when the international borders slammed shut and cargo flights were grounded, that specialized pharmaceutical supply simply vanished.
Exactly. And no hormones means no induced spawning. No spawning means the hatcheries produce no baby fish.
And if a farmer can't buy fingerlings, they cannot restock their ponds for the upcoming season. Their future revenue is instantly wiped out. The biological clock of the farm just stops.
It just completely stops.
But it gets worse because it's not just about the next generation of fish, right? What about the thousands of adult fish currently swimming in the ponds? If you're wondering why they couldn't just sell the fish early and cut their losses, remember the mobility restrictions. The markets were closed. The local transporters weren't running.
This traps the farmer in a terrifying financial limbo. They are sitting on a pond full of market-ready tilapia. But because they can't move the product, they have to keep the fish in the water weeks or even months longer than intended.
And those fish have to eat every single day.
They have to eat every single day.
Which introduces the next massive failure point, the feed. The study notes that farmers couldn't get their hands on fish feed. But why couldn't they just pivot to feeding them local scraps?
Because commercial fish feed is a highly engineered product. It requires specific ratios of digestible protein, usually derived from soybean meal or fish meal, alongside essential vitamins and lipids.
It's not just table scraps.
No, not at all. To get tilapia to grow quickly and stay healthy in dense populations, you need extruded pellets that float and provide exact nutritional profiles.
So you can't just toss random agricultural waste into a high-density pond without, I assume, destroying the water quality and starving the fish?
Precisely. And the local feed mills that produce these specialized pellets had to shut down during the lockdowns. They lost their labor force due to mobility restrictions, and they couldn't source the raw imported ingredients to even mix the feed.
Wow.
So the supply of feed plummets, and whatever feed is left on the market just skyrockets in price.
So the farmer is bleeding cash every single day. They are forced to buy exorbitantly priced, scarce feed just to keep their inventory alive, with absolutely no guarantee they will ever be able to sell the fish to recoup the costs.
It was a masterclass in systemic vulnerability. The farmers were essentially paying a daily ransom to keep their own livelihoods on life support.
You have all these stranded, expensive fish, the supply chains are completely frozen, but here's the immutable fact of a pandemic. Human beings still need to eat.
Right.
The biological demand for protein doesn't care if there's a virus. This collision between frozen supply and steady demand had a massive impact on the end product.
And the economic data from the respondents is very clear on this. 66% of the farmers stated the pandemic severely affected the prices of their aquaculture products.
Mm-hmm.
And the primary driver of that, cited by 58% of them, was the dramatic surge in the price of table-sized farmed fish.
It's a brutal economic equation. You have plummeting supply because the supply chain is broken and the fish can't get to market. You have intense local demand because people are locked down and looking for food close to home.
Mm-hmm.
And you have sky-high production costs because the farmers are paying a premium for whatever scarce feed and chemicals they can scavenge.
Every single ounce of that financial strain, the expensive feed, the scarce pharmaceuticals used to treat the water, the prolonged labor costs, all of it gets baked into the final price of the fish.
Mm-hmm.
The cost of a table-sized tilapia soared because simply getting a fish to survive to that size under lockdown conditions required an astronomical investment from the farmer.
Here's where it gets really interesting, though. We've been unpacking all this operational devastation, the crushing costs, the supply shortages, but buried in the study is this wild, totally counterintuitive observation. Amidst all this chaos, the water quality in many of these local fish farms actually improved.
Yes, it highlights a really profound paradox about how we interact with our environment.
It instantly reminded me of the first few months of the lockdowns when the internet was flooded with those nature is healing memes. You know, you had satellite images showing smog clearing over major cities and people claiming dolphins were returning to the canals in Venice.
Oh, I remember those.
Right. Yeah. This feels like the exact same concept, just playing out on a micro scale in the local fish ponds of the Sunyani municipality.
And if we connect this to the bigger picture, it makes perfect sense. To understand why the water got cleaner, you have to look at what normally pollutes it. It's almost entirely driven by anthropogenic activities.
Meaning the day-to-day footprint of human industry and movement.
Exactly. In a normal functioning economy, these rural ponds aren't isolated bubbles. They are surrounded by constant activity. You have neighboring agricultural farms spraying pesticides and fertilizers, which eventually run off into the water table.
Right.
You have trucks kicking up dust and leaking oil. You have constant human traffic disturbing the banks of the ponds.
But the lockdown just hits the pause button on all of that.
The ambient pollution simply vanished. The external stress on the local ecology was completely suspended. So while the economic machinery of the aquaculture business was tearing itself apart due to broken supply chains, the sheer absence of human interference allowed the biological environment of the water bodies to temporarily stabilize and clear up.
It's a stark reminder that our economic engine and our ecological health are so often pulling in completely opposite directions.
Very true.
But as fascinating as that ecological silver lining is, cleaner water doesn't buy fish feed. And it certainly doesn't pay back the massive debts these farmers were accruing. The crisis really forced a reckoning, which brings us to the solutions proposed in the study. How do these farmers brace for the next global shockwave?
Well, the authors offer a very specific, practical recommendation to prevent this kind of operational freeze in the future. They argue that farmers need to fundamentally change how they procure supplies, shifting toward bulk purchasing of aquaculture materials.
Meaning they need to buy massive quantities of fish feed, pituitary hormones, and water treatment chemicals like lime well in advance.
Yes. The rationale is that if you hold a significant inventory of inputs on site, you create a buffer. When the global supply chain freezes, you can maintain steady farm operations, feed your fish, induce spawning, and protect your profit margins without relying on real-time deliveries.
Okay, I have to be honest. When I read that recommendation, the very first thing I wrote in my notes was, this is the Costco trap.
The Costco trap. I like that. Expand on that for a second.
Think about it from the perspective of someone living paycheck to paycheck. A financial advisor tells them they can save a ton of money and secure their household by buying a year's supply of toilet paper, rice, and canned goods at a giant warehouse club.
Right.
Mathematically, it is flawless logic. The unit price is lower, and you're insulated from sudden price hikes. But how does a family with zero disposable income afford the massive upfront cost of buying in bulk?
This raises an important question, and it cuts right to the heart of the systemic vulnerability we've been discussing.
Yeah.
The authors of the study actually acknowledge this exact irony in their practical implications. They note that these small-scale aquaculture firms face intense competition, lack of innovation, and harsh regulations.
Because it's not just about the money, right? It's the physical reality of the product. Fish feed isn't toilet paper. It is highly perishable.
Extremely perishable. If you buy a 6-month supply of extruded fish feed, you can't just leave it in a pile in the corner of a field. It requires serious storage infrastructure. It needs climate-controlled, dry environments to prevent mold.
Oh.
Yeah, if feed gets damp, it produces aflatoxins, which will wipe out your entire pond. It has to be protected from rodents and pests. The fats in the feed can go rancid if exposed to too much heat.
So, to survive a supply chain crisis, the small-scale farmer just needs huge amounts of liquid capital to hoard supplies and advanced climate-controlled warehousing to store it all, which are the exact two things a rural pond farmer fundamentally lacks.
Look at the income data from the survey. It's sobering. 22% of these highly educated farmers were making between 3,001 and 4,000 Ghanaian cedis a month. Another 36% were making between 2,001 and 3,000 cedis.
That's not a lot of wiggle room.
Not at all. They are operating on razor-thin margins. They simply do not have the financial elasticity to execute a bulk purchasing strategy. The theoretical solution is completely divorced from their financial reality.
So the prevailing advice is essentially, the best way to survive a crisis while being under-resourced is to simply have more money and better infrastructure. Feels like a paradox.
What
is the actual realistic path forward for these farmers if they can't hoard commercial feed?
The study pivots to a dual approach, recognizing that the global supply chain cannot be trusted as a lifeline. For the farmers themselves, the mandate is local innovation. They have to reduce their reliance on imported, commercial feeds, and specialized pharmaceuticals. The recommendation is to supplement their operations by formulating farm-made feeds using cheaper, locally available agricultural byproducts.
But we established earlier that formulating feed requires precise protein ratios and specialized knowledge. If the government extension workers don't even have vehicles to reach the farms, who is teaching these farmers how to safely process local ingredients into viable floating fish feed?
And that is the crux of the second part of the solution. The burden of surviving a catastrophic global supply chain collapse cannot rest entirely on the shoulders of an individual pond farmer in Sunyani. The study issues a clear call for the government to step in and fill the void.
Because the multiplier effect we talked about earlier proves these farmers are too important to fail.
Exactly. The government needs to actively subsidize these essential inputs, like feed and pharmaceuticals, to build a safety net. They need to fund localized aquaculture research to figure out the best recipes for farm-made feeds using regional ingredients.
That makes total sense.
And crucially, they need to build out the physical infrastructure, the roads, the storage facilities, the cold chains, so that when the next shockwave hits, the local microeconomy can sustain itself.
So what does this all mean? We started this deep dive talking about earthquakes and microscopic fault lines. I think the biggest takeaway for you listening to this right now is that an abstract macroeconomic term like global supply chain disruption isn't just a red line going down on a graph on the evening news.
It's very real.
It has a face and it has a very specific geography. It looks like a highly educated farmer in Sunyani, Ghana, staring out at a static pond full of hungry tilapia, desperately trying to track down a specialized shipment of pituitary hormones just so they can breed the next generation of fish and keep their community fed. It reveals just how deeply interconnected and, frankly, how terrifyingly fragile the systems keeping us fed truly are.
It is a humbling perspective. And I'm going to leave you with a final thought to mull over as you go about your day. We spend so much of our energy analyzing and worrying about the massive industrial mega farms and the multinational shipping conglomerates that stock the aisles of our major supermarkets. But based on what we've learned today about the incredible economic engine, that multiplier effect of those small earthen ponds, take a look at your own neighborhood. What invisible, hyper-local food systems are quietly holding up your own community's economy right now? And more importantly, are they just one missing delivery truck away from a total collapse?
That is a very sobering thought to end on, but an essential one to carry forward. Thank you for joining us on this deep dive. Keep questioning the world around you, look a little closer at the invisible networks that bring food to your table, and we will catch you next time.